in recent months, forcing an industry already buffeted by pandemic lockdowns and fights over mask requirements to deal with a new problem. This level of violence has taken it to a whole new level, says Rachel Michelin, president of the California Retailers Association. No one has seen this before. Luxury retailers in Union Square in San Francisco, the site of several high-profile robberies this year, have boarded up windows to prevent more mayhem. Best Buy warned last week that theft was lowering profit margins and said it was using QR codes for checkout in some areas so employees did not need to unlock items right away. Home Depot has hardened its stores, putting power tools and other valuables out of reach and advising employees not to film robberies with their mobile phones because it could escalate the situation. It has become second nature to take out your phone and record something when it is happening, said Scott Glenn, vice president of asset protection at Home Depot, but these people are getting violent. Retail executives and security experts link the thefts to a confluence of factors, but primarily the ease with which thieves have been able to resell stolen goods on internet in places in websites like Amazon and Facebook. But even industry veterans who have been tracking generations of shoplifters have been stunned by the methods and mindset of the thieves, saying they reflect a sense of impunity. Some recent robberies in which large groups rush into a store, overwhelm employees and flee in cars before the police can respond recall the looting that occurred across the country amid protests after the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. At that time, people took advantage of police departments stretched by the protests and ransacked hundreds of stores, including the Macy's in Herald Square, and many smaller retailers, causing millions of dollars worth of damage. As tensions flared across the nation, major retailers like Nordstrom and Target would not discuss the extent of damage to their stores or how many they had to close during protests, instead focusing on their empathy for the demonstrators. The designer, Marc Jacobs, wrote on Instagram, "Never let them convince you that broken glass or property is violence. Property can be replaced, human lives cannot." With the unrest subsided, retailers are less reluctant to talk publicly about theft. Looting in general started during civil unrest, and it has now evolved, said Ben Duggan, president of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail, a trade group focused on crime at retailers. Criminal organizations saw during civil unrest that they were able to get their hands on millions of dollars of stolen products very quickly. The rise in thefts comes as punishments for retail theft have been broadly eased over the past decade. Since 2005, 30 states have increased the dollar threshold for theft offenses, which effectively means that fewer people are going to jail for smaller thefts, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. More than half of the states now have a felony theft threshold of $1,000 or more. The theft laws were changed to help reduce incarceration rates across the country, and some studies have found that the lower penalties have not led to more crime. And many of the most brazen crimes committed around Thanksgiving far exceeded the $1,000 threshold. Still, the thefts are being politicized, with some leaders saying they show the failure of decriminalization efforts. Others worry that the recent crimes could be used as a pretext to ratchet up penalties and incarceration rates again. Some industry experts say the problem is not necessarily the laws, but the lack of enforcement by the police and prosecutors, which emboldens enterprising thieves. A big priority, they say, should be breaking up the criminal organizations directing and profiting the most from the thefts. Ms. Michener, the head of the California Retail Trade Group, has been meeting with local prosecutors and the governor's office, which has established a task force on organized retail crime, trying to raise the urgency of prosecuting these cases. "The level of organized retail theft we are seeing today is simply unacceptable," California's Governor Gavin Newsom said in a statement. He added, "Businesses and customers should feel safe when doing their holiday shopping." Speaking to reporters on Friday, 3rd of December, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said federal law enforcement officials had been in contact with jurisdictions where we have seen this high level of retail theft. She added that the FBI was working with a task force led by the Los Angeles Police Department and that the Justice Department was providing money to hire 50 additional police officers in San Francisco, California. Both the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco have experienced high-profile retail robberies in recent weeks. Mr. Duggan, who has worked with a slew of major retailers and pharmacy chains like Walgreens, said that often the people snatching items are paid small fees like $500 for each robbery, which then feed larger enterprises that resell the goods online. Typically, these robberies don't involve large groups looting stores, but instead are smaller thefts that build up over time. In one recent case, a 70-year-old man in Atlanta, Georgia, paid recovering drug addicts to steal razors and health products from stores like Target, CVS, and Publix, and take them to his warehouse, according to court documents. The man, Robert Whitley, then sold the items online through businesses called Closeout Express and Essential Daily Discounts. He sold more than 140,000 items on Amazon's marketplace, totaling $3.5 million, according to federal prosecutors. Robert Whitley's lawyer said the thefts never involved violence. He said Mr. Whitley, who had struggled with drug addiction himself, ran support groups and provided shelter for others struggling with substance abuse. Robert Whitley, who pleaded guilty to one count of interstate transportation of stolen property, was sentenced in October to nearly 6 years in federal prison. His daughter, Nonnie Whitley, who was accused of being part of the illegal operation, was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. Similar cases have occurred from Katy, Texas to Charlotte, North Carolina, and help explain why in many big box chains and drugstores around the country, items like teeth whitening strips and razor blades are increasingly being put behind lock and key. Stolen goods used to show up at flea markets and pawn shops, but that has changed in recent years. One of the biggest issues that brick-and-mortar retailers have been grappling with is the rapid growth of online marketplaces, where anyone can easily sell goods, often anonymously. Amazon, eBay, Facebook Marketplace, OfferUp, Etsy, all of those are utilized by illicit online sellers, and they're allowed to get away with it because the illicit sellers are allowed to operate with anonymity on the internet, Mr. Duggan said. They don't have to list their real name or real addresses or location or their real banking information, so no one is concerned about being caught if they're not even using their real name. Consumers are often unaware of the provenance of items they're buying, but issues can emerge with products like baby formula, which can be expired or otherwise compromised when stolen. The anonymity reflects yet another instance in which criminals stymied by rules in the physical world can operate freely on the internet, an issue that has surfaced in problems involving misinformation, questionable advertisements, and merchandise glorifying crimes. Pawn shops, for example, are regulated in almost every state, said Richard Rossman, a sergeant with the Broward County Sheriff's Office in Florida, who is also part of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail. The Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail has gotten support from industry groups and retailers, including pharmacy chains Home Depot and Ulta Beauty, on partisan legislation known as the Informed Consumers Act. The bill would require online marketplaces to authenticate the identity of high-volume third-party sellers, including their bank account information and tax identification, and allow consumers to see basic identification and contact information for those sellers. Etsy, OfferUp and eBay said they support the legislation after opposing a draft of the legislation that raised privacy and safety concerns for sellers. Meta said that Facebook Marketplace users could report items they thought were stolen and that law enforcement could contact the company regarding suspicious items. Amazon said in a statement that we regularly request invoices, purchase orders, and other proofs of sourcing when we have concerns about how a seller may have obtained particular products that they want to sell. Amazon added that it employed 10,000 people working to prevent fraud and abuse on its site and supported the Informed Consumers Act.
What would have happened if Hezbollah had been vanquished? That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war. How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 4.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and developments, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war. When considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war, one of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. Hezbollah's moves and reactions have already come under scrutiny in numerous occasions, and many of them have been based on personal judgments. This has been due to the secrecy of Hezbollah and its military activities, leading to a shortage of information available to those interested in studying the military doctrine of the Islamic resistance. But the July war provided military experts, especially the Israelis and Americans, with the opportunity to get acquainted with Hezbollah's operational strategies, particularly considering that the war was on a larger scale and longer than other Arab-Israeli wars. The main question of the military experts was whether Hezbollah had a pyramidal form of command, which enabled it to have such an effective control on its forces and equipment on the battlefield. What we present to you here is not the official stance of the resistance movement. Rather, it is a summary of what senior American and Israeli officers have said in their studies that recognizes a four-layered hierarchy of military command within Hezbollah. The High Operation Command Room, where Hezbollah Secretary General Seyed Hassan Nasrallah and most senior officers meet. This room is directly in contact with the second layer of the pyramid of command. The second layer is the Central Operations Room, run by operations officers equipped with the most advanced command, control, and guidance, communications, and computer facilities, generally known as the C4ISR. These are needed to lead battles. The operations room also features military intelligence and interception units that are tasked with tracking and tracing enemy moves. Such units are in local operations rooms, consisted of field officers who guide the battles directly and at close range. This room is in direct contact with the battle itself and issues the needed orders to infantry, anti-armor, and missile units, including those in charge of anti-destroyer missiles and other weapons. This is the hierarchy of military command in the form of a pyramid that begins with the top commander and goes all the way down to the foot soldiers on the battlefield. Hezbollah's commander of operations can control all parts of the frontline activities and therefore can even control the firing of a single missile. This makes its decisions for the battlefield balanced while giving units involved in the conflict special authorization to adopt appropriate tactical moves on the battlefield. Such an approach to commanding a battle is by no means a characteristic of guerrilla groups. Rather, Hezbollah presented a new method in the non-civilian battles doctrine in the July 2006 war. The climax of what we call pyramidal in the command and control hierarchy in the Islamic resistance came to light with the targeting of the Hanat destroyer. On the eve of the July 2006 war, the number of Israeli naval forces reached 5,500 Marines. Moreover, 6,600 reservists on standby for emergencies were also called in for the battle. The Israeli naval fleet, comprising of three Sa'ar 5-class destroyers, are distributed in the naval bases at Haifa, Atlit, Ashdod, and Eilat. There are also two other Sa'ar 4 destroyers and 8 Sa'ar 4.5 vessels, as well as 89 patrol boats of different classes. From the very beginning, the Israeli Navy was tasked with encircling Lebanon, and two of its units attacked Lebanese shoreline. One of these two units was the Sa'ar 5-class Hanat destroyer.
The technical features of the destroyer make it one of the best in service around the world. It has a stealth body form, which means all its structures and facilities are designed with obtuse angles. Aside from this feature, which is now common in the world, what was uncommon, rare, and exclusive to this destroyer was that it could hide its thermal trace through cooling its own body. The vessel's engine are covered by a two-story structure where constant flow of water cools exhaust gas from the engines little by little to hide their thermal trace. Israel knew that some Arab countries are aware of its highly advanced electronic technology and its ability to scatter signals that misled missiles fired at its destroyers, and that they had turned to thermal missiles. Hanat and its two peers are the only existing destroyers in the world that leave no thermal trace of themselves.
Hezbollah
On the second day of the war in the morning, Hannett, along with a small fleet of four destroyers, left for the battle. They were accompanied by three patrol boats. Some of them were dispatched from the port of Haifa and others from Ashdod. Seven ships lined up in a stretch of water between 16 miles off Lebanese waters and Lebanon's Nahura city in the north.
The destroyer is armed with a full set of weaponry, including American 120-kilometer range Gabriel and Barak missiles. Each of its defensive packets consists of 32 missiles. It also has a 76-millimeter automatic cannon along with a fast-firing cannon. Even more importantly, it enjoys highly sophisticated electronic warfare equipment. The vessel is also armed with a stealth jamming system that creates false frequencies around the real target to mislead incoming missiles. Hezbollah's top command ordered an attack on the enemy where it least expected, that is on the sea. And it was done by a weapon that caused Israelis the first surprise of the battle, as they were earlier promised by the resistance movement's Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Hezbollah had secretly trained an anti-destroyer missile unit capable of operating in the most difficult and sophisticated battlefield conditions. All that was done out of the range of Israel's espionage apparatus.
The Islamic Resistance Command issued an order to the anti-destroyer units in the evening of the second day of the July War. The units were ordered to give an immediate and crushing response to the Israeli Navy after it violated the territorial waters off Lebanon's capital Beirut and attacked the southern Zahia region of the city. According to Israeli intelligence sources, the system, exclusively developed for transport and operation of C-802 missiles, was deployed on a height in southern Beirut overlooking the sea. Two groups were in charge of launching the missile. The first was tasked with examining the situation at sea to recognize the target and review the radar information, and the second was the launching squad who used the gathered data to activate the missile's electronic devices to guide them to their targets. They were also tasked with preparing the launch pad for the zero hour. Resistance Movement's Operation Room issued the order of attack at 0800 p.m. local time while Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was delivering a live TV address broadcast from Al-Manar channel. A brilliant light, coupled with a thundering noise, filled the air as the two missiles were fired.
You bet on your logic, and we rely on our power to take risks. Surely, we have the assistance and support of God. We have never challenged you, except by reliance on God's assistance and our nation and hearts and children. Today, we renew our pledge that victory is near at hand with the help of God.
One of Nasrallah's deputies rushed toward him to tell him that the mission had been accomplished. Nasrallah suddenly changed the subject to the targeting of the Israeli destroyer and the surprises the battle had for the enemy. That was a turning point in the war.
The surprises I had promised will happen from now on. Now look at the waters off Beirut and the Israeli destroyer, which targeted our infrastructure and our people's homes, and see how it is burning in flames.
وعلى المدنيين انظروا إليها تحت وقف.
Everything happened when Israel's Chief of General Staff, Dan Halutz, was at a press conference briefing reporters on the accomplishments of the first airstrike.
What made the achievement even more fascinating was that the Israeli destroyer was attacked during Nasrallah's media address when people had their attention focused on Hezbollah. Therefore, it became a memorable blow to Israel thanks to how the attack was conducted.
It is remarkable how Israelis resorted to humiliating language to justify the destroyer's weaknesses. For example, they said, the destroyer's electronic warfare systems were not active. This is the stupidest thing a military force can say after it has waged an all-out war against Lebanon and Hezbollah. Imagine they have dispatched a destroyer and it is firing at Lebanese targets and leading the naval offensive, but its electronic warfare systems are inactive. In fact, the humiliation was so huge for the Israelis that forced them to use such justifications. I don't think anybody familiar with the matter has accepted their justification for the first destroyer. Some in the uninformed Israeli public may have accepted it, but if we accept the justification for the attack on the first Israeli vessel, what should we think of the attack on the second? What about the second and the third attacks? Three vessels, two Tsar-class destroyers and a smaller one were targeted. It is interesting that Al Jazeera TV channel showed live pictures of the third destroyer when it was hit.
The missiles closed in on Hanid freely and without any problem. One of the missiles missed the destroyer, but the second hit the 85-meter-long target at its rear part, where a military helicopter had been landing. The point of impact was on the vessel, and the missile exploded over its deck rather than inside the destroyer's body. The explosion triggered a large fire, with the nearby helicopter fuel tanks nourishing the flames. Chaos reigned among the destroyer's 80-member crew. Even after several minutes, they had not realized that the explosion was caused by an enemy missile impact. Two hours after the fire broke out, they realized that four soldiers, including two intelligence officers and two Air Force troops, had been killed. The damage to the vessel was estimated at $40 million, one-fourth of its total value, and forced it out of service for more than a year.
Some media and military resources have revealed that the casualties were 24 people rather than four. The news has come out over the past month. In fact, the four were torn to pieces by the explosion. Four are missing and others have suffered critical injuries. Meanwhile, the Israeli Navy was hit with mayhem for 20 hours after the attack, despite Israel's claim that the force was fully organized and in a better condition than before. There's also no news of the Hanit's return to the Navy in the Jane's Fighting Ships website.
It was one of those incidents that the Zionist enemy never imagined to happen. They deemed it likely that their tanks would be hit, or that they lose their infantry units, or even that a Hezbollah missile would target the occupied territories. But they never imagined that their ultra-modern destroyer would be hit at sea, where they felt no military threat. It is God's will that the destroyer is targeted, just as Sayyid Hassan is delivering his TV address, so that he says at the end that people can go to Beirut's coastlines and see the destroyer burning in flames. The incident was a shock not only to the Israelis, but also to the world. You know that major military powers such as the U.S. are marine-based. Their air force is marine-based, and even their land units are stationed on vessels.
The next day, the Israeli Air Force launched a number of attacks on all the Lebanese Army's radar bases. Israelis believed that Lebanon's army radars had contributed to the targeting of the destroyer. They unleashed a 30-minute non-stop attack on the Ozai port and some hills overlooking the sea. The Israeli Navy failed to tow Hanid away from Lebanese waters in 3 days, and they had to ask for help from the U.S. Navy to transfer it to the port of Ashdod in the south of the Palestinian-occupied territories. The destroyer was towed to Ashdod because the Israeli Navy's main base at Haifa was within the range of the resistance movement's missiles, so the Israelis fully evacuated the port.
The 33-day war almost led to the elimination of what we formerly knew as the Israeli Navy. When you refer to the data available on Israel, including satellite images, you see no sign of Israeli vessels, neither in Haifa, which is the Israeli Navy's main hub, nor in Tel Aviv and their entire Israeli marine borders. You see no Israeli Navy vessels, neither close to the Lebanese borders, nor in the vicinity of Palestine. You will find no trace ever of the two-star class destroyers and the Israeli frigate that accompanied them.
Hezbollah's military command created a unique and advanced anti-naval force with the help of land-to-sea missiles. Hezbollah used the capability 3 times during the war, and they surprised commanders of the Israeli fleet, who closely pursued the battle every single time.
The key question is how such a destroyer can be targeted by a guerrilla group. The main issue is the highly confidential technology used by the units that prepared for the attack and fired the missile. As technologically speaking, launching of a missile toward such a target is no easy task. The Sa'ar 5 incident shattered the dreams of many world countries that looked up at a vessel as the apex of the technology used in their own Sa'ar 2, 3.5, 4, and 4.5 destroyers. How Hezbollah forces managed to do that, while they are not even a naval force or an organized coastal guard? They are rather a group of ordinary people with a will to fight, who were secretly trained and secretly advanced towards the enemy, dealt a blow and withdrew, without ever being identified by the enemy. That was realized despite the enemy being equipped with satellites and unmanned drones, which provided it with the entire picture of the situation during the conflict. These brave people managed to beat the enemy despite the fact that targeting of the destroyer was no easy task.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah ended his speech, and Beirut was filled with joy as people took to the streets to watch the burning destroyer at sea.
أي حرب مقبلة تريدون شنها على لبنان.
In every war that you may be going to wage against Lebanon in the future, if you besiege our ports, the entire fleet of your military, civilian and trade vessels heading toward Palestinian ports in the Mediterranean, will come under fire by the Islamic resistance.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The real threat against the U.S. is that of detached politicians who are amassing wealth, fighting for power and prestige, while their countrymen and women continue to go hungry, says Ramzi Baruth, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden's real challenge is not Russia or China, but poverty in America. Here's the story. Mainstream U.S. media continues to celebrate the supposed strength of the U.S. economy. Almost daily, headlines speak of hopeful numbers, sustainable growth, positive trends, and constant gains. The reality on the ground, however, tells of something entirely different, which raises the question, are Americans being lied to, and for what purpose? U.S. economy grew 1.7% in fourth quarter, capping a strong year, the New York Times reported. U.S. economy grew 5.7% in 2021, fastest full-year clip, the Washington Post added. Reuters, Voice of America, the Financial Times, CNN, MarketWatch, and many others all concurred. But if that is the case, why then is U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating at an all-time low? And why are many Americans literally going hungry? In a national opinion poll conducted by Reuters Ipsos and published on February 3rd, only 41% of U.S. adults approved of Biden's performance in office. A whopping 56% disapproved. The numbers were not a complete shock, as the downward trajectory of the Biden presidency has been in effect soon after he moved to the White House over a year ago. The truth is, Biden was not the Democrats' top choice nominee for president. Judging by various opinion polls and the early results of the Democratic primaries in 2020, it was Bernie Sanders who represented the Democratic hope for real, substantive change. Party politics, liberal media insistence that Sanders was not electable, and fear-mongering regarding a second Trump term in office pushed Biden through the ranks of nominees to be presented as America's only hope for salvation. While Republicans remain committed to the Donald Trump's legacy and are still largely politically and ideologically united, Democrats are growingly unconfident in their leadership and uncertain regarding the future of their democracy, governance, and economy. Of course, they are blameless in holding such views. While the Democratic leadership continues to obsess with its fear of Trump, and while liberal media insists that the U.S. economy is as healthy as it can be, The average American continues to struggle against encroaching poverty, inflation, and lack of future prospects. Here are some of sobering numbers. 56% of all Americans cannot produce a meager $1,000 as an emergency expense from their existing savings, CNBC reported. 1 in 10 U.S. adults have gone hungry last December as a result of poverty, Forbes.com reported. Columbia University Center on Poverty and Social Policy revealed that child poverty rate in the United States stands at 17%, one of the highest among developed countries. If American workers are studied separately from the larger population, the numbers are even more grim. 3/4 of American workers said that it was very or somewhat difficult to make ends meet, according to a study conducted by Shift Project and reported in NBC News Online. 40% of the polled workers said they're not able to come up with $400 in emergency money. But the most shocking of all, according to the same study, is that around 20% said they went hungry because they shouldn't and couldn't afford enough to eat. Aside from occasional government handouts, which were provided by both the Trump and Biden administrations, little has been done by way of structural changes to the U.S. economy that would ensure greater equality among all sectors of society. Instead, the administration's priorities seem to be allocated to something else entirely. Writing in Politico, David Siders describes the current political discourse within Democratic Party circles where Democrats are losing their minds over 2024. Since the Democratic president's public approval ratings are dismal, Democrats fear the return of Trump. All anyone can talk about is Trump, donors, policy folks, party insiders, and the media. Siders quoted a Democratic advisor as saying the same advisor described a weird cycle where the conversation keeps coming back to Trump. Whether conscious of this obsession or not, the Biden administration seems to operate entirely according to a political strategy that is predicated on tarnishing Trump and his supporters, retelling over and over again the story of the January 6th insurrection, hoping for a Republican split or any other miracle that would bolster their chances of maintaining their congressional majority in the next November amid term elections. While doing so, the Democratic leadership seems oblivious to the harsh reality on the ground, where food prices are skyrocketing and where inflation has reached unbearable levels. According to new data released on February 10th by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. Consumer Price Index, CPI, rose by 7.5% in January compared to the same month a year ago, making it the fastest annual pace since 1982, the Financial Times reported. The rise in inflation is not a one-time-off event, as CPI has been rising at a sustainable level of 0.6% on a monthly basis. Ordinary people can feel this increase almost every time they go shopping. Small business owners, especially restaurants, bakeries, and grocery stores, are left with one out of two options, either increasing their prices or shutting down completely. Consequently, large segments of the already vulnerable U.S. population are growing more desperate than ever. to avoid providing real answers to difficult questions about the welfare of millions of Americans, about the real function of their democratic institutions, and about existing corruption within the U.S. political system, regardless of who controls the Congress or resides in the White House, Democrats and their media are either blaming their Republican rivals or creating foreign policy distractions. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Urile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Urile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though as these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but as we see in this documentary, it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime, and we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, it's quite commonplace because that's an important source of income. And this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks, you know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context. So that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes.
Which is absolutely camps, breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya. Over to the skyscrapers of New York. You could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. Really is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Matanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Vinnie, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there, but, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekla Lorupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
In 1993, I heard about Tekla.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Arile and Matanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve... they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction, so that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Matanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500, effectively, gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. So this guy's a people organizer. And, of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Arile, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid he was winning things at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive, is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was he said, well, the skills I need to run I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in the marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand
exactly.
with their ability to be good athletes.
Yeah.
And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Matanda who's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you?
And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually he doesn't, they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
So I know you'd like to jump in, but we're just going to pause just for a second as we take a look at another clip from Gunrunners, which shows Robert Matanda tell us about the significance of marathon running.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find the difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you. And then you'll be in a hot soup.
Look outside, the people are running. Town breathes, eats, sleeps, imagines, fantasizes, athletics. The odds 1 out of 10 that you can make money out of it. And 1 in 50 to really make money out of it and start really changing your life. The luck of getting a manager that supports you and brings you to races for around a 15% commission is crucial. There is a big boulevard of broken dreams here in Ite. A big one, a big, big, big one. But some people walk over the boulevard of broken dreams, still thinking they can make it.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Matanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Relay. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Relay's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different. So you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Matanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Relay is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Matanda pursue politics, but then, of course, we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that is that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflicts. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years.